We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft. But Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Three, two, one, zero. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Welcome back to the UFO show. My name is Ty Hildebrand. Joining me, as always, over there in wintry Chicagoland. Actually, I guess it's not more wintry than here over in eastern
I'd
PA
say less.
Land.
Yeah.
With our 10 inches of snow on the ground. But Mr. Rubenstein, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I am looking forward to this annual show that we do and reviewing. You know what? I haven't heard the term lifeblood as much as I normally do this week.
Yeah.
Maybe or read or heard. Maybe I'm just watching a lot less ESPNU. I really am, though. I usually love signing day or early signing day, but it seemed to be kind of devoid of the usual drama, hasn't it? Because there's the fewer announcement ceremonies, there's fewer last-second secret visits that result in flips. It seemed like a workmanlike early signing day, did it not?
Fewer recruits actually being able to play their senior seasons. Yeah, all sorts of nuance to this recruiting cycle. And look, you know where I stand on recruiting.
You often anonymously threaten prospects online.
Well, outside of that. Outside of that, I'm always looking for a new angle that can make it interesting, a wrinkle.
Sure.
Right? That's why we talk about announcement ceremonies and funny names and things of that ilk. This year, there's more than enough to at least make it interesting. I'm not saying it's favorable with respect to how you recruited some of the stars of tomorrow. Far from it. But given that travel has been restricted, that seasons weren't being played, that eligibility rules up and down the sport have been drastically altered.
Ability to evaluate coaches in person, recruiting writers, not being able to be at games and travel and camps and All-American games and practices altered. Very different experience.
There is a lot that we need to cover with our guest du jour. His name is Brandon Hoffman. You know him well from 24/7 Sports. We're going to have him on momentarily, Dan. The other bit of news that I want to share, there's not a whole lot of news. I'm not going to play the sound. We had an extension for your boy, Mario Cristobal. We had Les Miles getting a vote of confidence despite a winless season.
And why not?
We had a couple other schools opting out of their bowl games, which we'll talk about more as you progress through into the offseason. But
I count eight at the moment, by the way. UCLA, Kansas State, Virginia Tech, Stanford, Virginia, Pitt, Georgia Tech, Boston College.
And Virginia Tech. Don't forget Virginia
Tech. Yeah, I said Virginia Tech in there, yeah.
But the big news here is that Play Winter Wonders, our super secret Patreon-only game, is now live. We've got our first batch of questions live
for our participants. That's like a prop bet listing, yeah.
To select. we've got a couple things going on. So each game, right? Each game you pick the winner against the spread. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit harder, right? We do that just normally, but then it gets a little bit harder. Then we start talking about, all right, well, how many total rushing yards will App State have in their bowl game against North Texas? Total rushing yards.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go a layer deeper, Dan, just that fantasy things layer that we, I think, hinted at.
We start doxing athletes. No?
How many times will the announcers reference App State's thrilling upset of Michigan way back when?
That's true. Setting over under.
Over under 1.5.
Man, I almost don't want to reveal all of these props because they could be altered. We could have inside jobs.
Ooh, that's right. We do know a lot of folks.
We have a number of announcers. Yeah.
We do know a lot of folks here. Okay, we're not going to reveal that publicly, but there are more props like that. We've got the standard issue against the spread. We've got the layer deeper about specific total rushing yards or passing touchdowns, things like
that. Pop culture references, B-roll. Video footage, yeah.
Then we get the solid verbal layer that puts a bow on all of it. PlayWinterWonders.com is where you can find all the info on how to join our special bowl pool. I also activated the confidence pool over on ESPN.com earlier today. So
you just go there and search solid verbal?
Yep, go there, search
on socials.
Search for the solid verbal. If you were in the group last year, you should be able to just click rejoin. If not, just search for the solid verbal. It's one of the bigger groups out on ESPN.com. And so we're going to play this bowl season a couple different ways. The games actually start on Monday. So we'll have to talk a little bit more about that on Sunday and certainly as we go through next week. But that's the big thing going on in our world outside of early signing day, outside of conference championship games, which, as many of you listen on Friday, are going to be taking place later tonight and all throughout the day tomorrow.
True. Very true. What was your recruiting cycle as a Notre Dame fan like for you? I mean, I come in and out of checking how Oregon's doing, et cetera, et cetera. Were you more attached, less attached? You're spending more time at home in front of a laptop. You know, you can check on these things probably more often than you can when you're at the secret day job overseas. So what was your involvement level with Notre Dame's class this year and recruiting as a whole?
I always follow recruiting from afar. So okay. I'll check in a couple times throughout the course of the cycle. I certainly don't know it as well as a number of folks who listen to this show and live and die by it. But I have been particularly interested, and I'm going to ask Brandon about Tyler Buchner from California, but going to Notre Dame, because a friend, Pete Sampson, wrote a nice piece for The Athletic on just some of the challenges that he faced not being able to play his senior year. I have at least paid attention on that level because this has been such a quirky season, and that extends all the way through to recruiting as well. We're going to have subjects that came up with regard to this recruiting cycle that probably won't ever happen again. And that aspect of it, at least to me, is interesting. I've enjoyed looking at what's going on and thinking about what are the longer term ramifications of all this.
I just looked up, what did you say his name? Tyler Buchner?
Yeah.
He's from La Mesa, California, San Diego area. If you do a Google image search for La Mesa, California, Spanish for the table, doesn't look like South Bend. it's going to be different. I don't know. Maybe he's from Indiana originally, but this is, holy moly, is it beautiful down there. Not to say South Bend doesn't have its own beauty. I've been, but it's not this. So, yeah, I mean, that's all going to be very different this year. A lot of guys not spending as much time on campus during the season, you know, official visits, unofficial visits. And excited to talk to Brandon. He's always just the absolute best and an encyclopedia of both the, you know, drilling down on the details and the big picture stuff.
Totally. Totally. Well, let's not waste any time. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. If you haven't already, don't forget to go on out and follow us on social media if you don't already. Shall we dance, Daniel?
I've been waiting.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Joining us now to help break down the recruiting scene, it was National Signing Day. I also
believe early signing day.
We got two now.
Yeah.
I believe this is also the first time we've ever had someone calling in from the last frontier, Dan. The land of the midnight sun, the great state of Alaska. Brandon Huffman, how are you?
I can see Russia from my hotel room.
Whoa! How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're good. Great. Why are you in Alaska?
So I have a buddy who's running a camp. He's running a football camp that goes that supports the Avery Huffman Foundation. And he's been doing a number of camps over a few years around the West Coast and says, hey, let's do one to Alaska. And let's do it in December. And I'm like, there's no better time of year to go to Alaska than in December, where it's going to be in the teens all week. So here we are for the very first Avery Strong Alaska Showcase. And there's probably about 100 kids from Alaska all throughout the state coming to this camp this weekend. So wow. I'm going on behalf of our foundation and getting to watch these guys play football. So it's going to be, and I brought my son with me. So, you know, I'm going to make the most of freezing in places I didn't think I could possibly freeze.
Yeah. Okay.
Mining for talent, Ty.
Yeah, that's
mining
what he does.
Because in Alaska, there was a gold rush as well.
That's what he does. He's a national recruiting editor for 24/7 Sports. Of course, early signing day in the books. And surprise, surprise, Brandon, Alabama again on track for the top class yet again. Of note, this year, they snagged four of the top 10 wide receiver recruits in the class, one of which they flipped from LSU. We're so far beyond calling these classes ridiculous at this point. I guess the operative question, and we ask it every year, is which of the guys that they're bringing in have the best chance to make a real impact in the 2021 cycle?
Well, I mean, here's what's crazy. They still might not even be done at adding to this class because they're one of the five finalists for the number one overall player in the country by 24/7 Sports, JT Tuimoloau. So if they get him, I mean, I think we were talking about this yesterday, that would put them potentially as the highest rated class in recruiting history, at least in the 24/7 era. Jeez. And so that's what their class still could potentially be. Ohio State's second right now behind them, and they could get him. So that might close it a little bit. But the guys that they got signatures from, you got J.C. Latham, who's the number one offensive lineman in the country, who, you know, obviously Alex Leatherwood graduating. You've got some other upperclassmen there. He's a 6'6", 300-pounder who can just move like a gazelle, and he's a tackle prospect that probably plays early. Maybe he doesn't start right away as a true freshman, but it wouldn't surprise me. On the other side of tackle, they got the number two tackle in the country, Tommy Brockemeyer, and that was a big blow to Texas. That was kind of one of those first recruiting kind of losses Tom Herman took this offseason that really started to make the always hot seat even warmer. His father played at Texas. I believe his mom went there as well. And Tommy and his twin brother, who's not as highly rated as Tommy, both signed with Alabama. Then you throw in Dallas Turner, the elite pass rusher. So even if they don't get JT, who's the number one strong side defensive end, they've got the number one weak side defensive end coming in Dallas Turner. You got JaQuincy McKinstry, who's an actual Alabama kid who's coming from in-state. And we haven't even gotten to any of the receivers yet. It was to the point yesterday where Xavier Worthy, who's a top 100 player, ultimately chose to stay with Michigan rather than flip to Alabama, because even though he's a top 100 receiver, they had so much good receiver talent coming in that it's scaring others away.
So I don't think we should go any further without kind of getting into the actual context of a very different recruiting cycle because of limitations slash no ability to go on official visits and for coaches to see prospects in person for the majority of the senior years of these guys, and in-home visits not being available because the dead period is still ongoing. What is this, just a fully upside down recruiting cycle? Is it more similar than I'm giving it credit for? What do we need to know about the realities of this past cycle?
Well, here's what you need to know, and I think you guys have probably talked about this before. The NCAA is going to vote in January about the one-time transfer rule, where you can transfer without sitting out penalty, which the timing couldn't be more perfect because of how many guys had to make commitments to schools, school site unseen, town unseen, campus facilities unseen. Heck, these guys haven't even seen the coaches that they signed to play for in person. They basically have done their, you know, their homework on an LCD phone screen or an iPad or a computer. On the flip side, a lot of college coaches kind of felt like they needed to fill out their recruiting classes. So if they needed to fill 20, 25 spots, there's probably at least half of those guys they've never physically seen in person. They're having to rely on the video. They're having to rely on the pictures with no camp, with no in-person evaluation. So I have a feeling there's going to be some regrets by both parties over the next 12, 13 months. I anticipate a very loaded transfer portal about a year from now. But what the other thing is, I think it also took away a lot of the intrigue and drama from yesterday, because so many guys were worried and concerned about being left behind. There were far more earlier commitments this year than we've ever seen in the recruiting year. So more guys just secured their place at the table and then ultimately signed because they still never had that opportunity. Some guys were making reservations, committing to schools with the expectation they would be able to take visits down the road. But when the visits were taken off the table, they just decided, I'm going to firm this up and then, you know, we'll see how I adjust when I get there.
Counterpoint, and maybe this is not based in reality at all, but is it possible that this could mean that prospects are making fewer decisions off of the emotions based around a huge win or a particularly charming head coach or position coach in his parents' living room or parties, facilities, an amazing nightlife in whatever college town he's visiting? Could we, maybe in some cases anyway, be looking at actually more pragmatic decision making?
1,000%. Guys are actually making the decision based on the relationship they're developing with this coach, is the trust. I mean, the trust on both sides is probably greater than it's ever been in this recruiting dynamic. But now there's not that last second Jordan Paytoning of a recruitment where that coach comes into the home for the in-home visit on a Saturday night, the last weekend, and gets the kid who's been committed to a school for 11 months to flip. You're seeing, you know, there's no intrigue with the last official visit. There weren't any official visits. There were hardly even unofficial visits this year taken. You had, you know, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten aren't letting fans in the stadium. So you had guys go to the Big 12 schools and go to SEC schools and still buy tickets to go and see those games. But when you take out 24 schools from having any kind of person inside the game that's not playing the game, guys weren't able to use that to let the emotions kind of sway them that way. So yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot more, you know, trust involved, but a lot better decision-making in the process. And it's not about who's got the sexiest uniforms or the best looking photo shoots or the best, you know, weekend party game day atmosphere. I think there's a lot more research that has been going in with kind of the free time that these guys have suddenly developed without being able to go to campuses.
Yeah. And Brandon, on the other side of the coin, we also have weird eligibility rules in 2020 for the kids who are already on campus, being so it's essentially a free year of eligibility. Has that had any impact on the recruiting trail?
Absolutely. And I think what you're having is a lot of schools that basically didn't fill classes yesterday, and they're not anticipating filling that class in February because there's no hard cap number that has been put down yet to know how many guys can you have on scholarship at a maximum. Maybe you were planning to take 25 this year, but you've got 20 seniors that you thought were graduating and now all of them are planning to come back. You're on the hook for those. I had one Pac-12 school tell me at one point, you know, we don't know how many scholarships that the NCAA is going to allow us to max out at, but we're not Alabama or LSU. We can't necessarily afford 105, 110 guys on scholarship, right, we're on the hook for that. And so imagine now what group of five schools are at. They have a hard enough time getting to 85 scholarships. And now they have 20 seniors that don't want to leave. So schools have basically said that, you know what, we'll just hit the portal hard instead of filling our numbers now and wait and see what the attrition looks like after the season, after the spring, because there's so much uncertainty with what the NCAA is going to limit or cap that number at. Nobody wants to put too many guys on scholarship because that school now has to pay for all those guys.
Right. I mean, it's such a different year with regard to everything, especially recruiting. I think of a guy like a Tyler Buchner, who was the big quarterback recruit for Notre Dame. In a normal year, we're potentially talking about him starting as a true freshman ahead to 2021, but it's not been a normal year for those kids either, right? Like, first off, Ian Book could come back if he wanted. And two, Tyler Buchner couldn't play his senior season because of the virus. Our friend Pete Sampson over at The Athletic wrote about this. I know you guys over at 24/7 did as well. But like, how does this odd year where maybe we didn't have that extra year of development for some of these top recruits affect your expectations about how they perform as a freshman or even how they develop as a college recruit in general?
Or how you compare them to people who do play.
Right. And that's the thing. So you look at a guy like Jackson Dart, who signed with USC yesterday. You know, they say a lot of times your best ability is availability. Well, what did Jackson Dart do this season? He played 14 games. You know, that's more games than most states that were playing their seasons even played. He got a full 14-game schedule, and he went off this season. I think he had 40 touchdown passes, like four interceptions, ran for about 15 touchdowns. He took over at the same school Zach Wilson played his high school ball. So leads him to a state championship. He had, I think, a Utah State offer going into the season. By the time I got down to it, he was deciding between USC, UCLA, going to BYU, going to Arizona State. He had plenty of options and kind of bet on himself and became one of the hottest commodities. Then you get a guy like a Tyler Buchner, who there was the question, how good is he really? He's tearing up lower level San Diego football. So he makes the transfer to Helix High School, the same school Reggie Bush and Alex Smith played at, jumping from the lowest division in San Diego to the highest division in San Diego, but now he'll never have that opportunity. Another good example, and there's a kid in Portland, Nathan Rollins Kabanji, who's the number two player in the state of Oregon, who's committed to Oklahoma. At one point in his high school career, he was committed to play basketball at Washington State. His head coach at Jefferson High School at the time, Don Johnson Jr., who's now the director of high school relations at Oregon, convinced him to come play football, said, you can go play Pac-12 basketball as a 6'6 forward, or you can go play in the NFL as a 6'6 defensive end. He comes out for football, plays 10 games last year, has offers from all over the country, but then decides he's going to enroll early at Oklahoma. So now you've got a 6'6 pass rusher who is really a basketball player who's showing up at Oklahoma, which has all the worry in the world over time to say, hey, we get these defensive players, but they suddenly can't tackle in the biggest games of the year. Here's the guy who's going in, and he literally has 10 high school football games under his belt because he doesn't play his senior season. So you have the expectations thinking he's going to develop from his junior to senior year. Now that senior year is gone, he shows up to campus in the middle of January. And Oklahoma's going to have to get him ready to play. Maybe he doesn't play right away, but that's what you're talking about. You have a lot of guys that they still haven't even learned the game, and now they're on scholarship at a major university who has expectations. We need you to contribute.
Wow. I want to go back to quarterbacks for a second. And I guess if anything, recent history has told us that even though we look at this, what looks to be a pretty good roster of class of 2021 quarterbacks, history tells us this is not going to be their final stop playing college football. How good a job, I guess, as a whole, do you see this class of quarterbacks doing in terms of finding a good fit? Because sometimes there are years you're like, it doesn't make sense why this guy's going to Florida State or Cal or Texas or whatever, and he's going to be gone. Do you see this as a good fit year, or do you see history continuing, trends continuing?
Man, I mean, I saw the tweet you guys had this week about the 2020 college football quarterbacks and all the different paths. And as I'm looking at it, you can see that playing out with this class. I mean, you take the two guys that are the number one quarterbacks at their respective positions, Caleb Bloom, who's the number one dual threat. He's going to show up at Oklahoma next year. Most likely Spencer Rattler's holding on to that job for at least another year, if not 2 years. Then you got Sam Heward, who's coming in, who's ran air raid for 4 years or 3 years. Hopefully he's playing his fourth year at Kennedy Catholic. Now he's going to Washington, where his head coach is wearing hats to the press conference to say, run the damn ball. So is Sam Heward going to come in and pass up Dylan Morris, who's doing a fine job help Washington win the Pac-12 North, you know, in a shortened season. But does he come in and, or does he wait? Maybe as an air raid quarterback, he's not the great fit for the Washington offense, or maybe the Washington offense is waiting to open things up when he gets there. But you look at those situations, and so you look at a guy like DJ Uiagalelei last year. He knew he was going to back up Trevor Lawrence, had no problem going to Clemson. Whereas Bryce Young flips that commitment when it becomes clear Tua's leaving, and then Mac Jones happens. So now I'm not saying that Bryce Young is going to transfer, but I'm saying right now that worry is very real, because is Mac Jones a great college quarterback, or is he an NFL prospect? Does he use this season to springboard to the NFL next year? Does he come back to play next fall? You know, so the fits look good on paper until you start looking at depth charts, and with the ability to use this season as essentially a redshirt year for everybody, there could be some depth charts that look much different than when the coach was pitching it to that that respective quarterback to try to get him to commit.
It's true. And then there aren't a number of surprises at the top. You talked about just how crazy deep Alabama's class is, but I mean, I guess outside of swapping in Oregon for USC within the top 10, what are the actual surprises to you in both impressive and disappointing fashion when you look across the sport?
Well, I think, you know, probably the most surprising is, and I mean, I don't know why we should be too surprised, because, you know, we kind of have expected this because he's always been a good recruiter, but despite having a horrible year on the field, Michigan's there at number 12. I mean, that kind of surprises me when you would have thought Michigan was leading everybody. They did lose a kid yesterday, a defensive lineman who'd been committed to them for 6 months, flipped to UCLA on signing day. So, but it's still kind of a surprise that even with all the uncertainty of Jim Harbaugh, they still have a top 12 class. You know, the other surprise, again, you got a school like Tennessee where they've had a disappointing season, yet they still have a top 15 class. I mean, Jerry Pruitt and his staff are still getting it done, but the recruiting is probably the only thing that's saving him at this point, because the results need to follow. So I think it's kind of a surprise that two programs that are, you know, kind of in year three, or in the case of Harbaugh, year five or six, they're able to get past some of the on-field results with still good recruiting class. On the flip side, I think Ole Miss fans are probably excited to see them back in the top 20 in the recruiting rankings. And nobody at this point, at least, has accused them of doing anything illicit to have a top 20 class. They just all say, hey, Lane Kiffin, he makes guys want to come play for him.
True.
What I love about Lane Kiffin is he was retweeting a kid that he flipped from Mississippi State. He retweeted one of his tweets that when he committed to Mississippi State. I mean, the troll level of Lane Kiffin is not a surprise. The surprise is that Ole Miss is showing under year one that, you know, Kiffin's going to be able to recruit at that level. But the one that really sticks out to me, I mean, there's actually two. Pitt at 23 and Cal at 25. I mean, we don't necessarily think Pitt and Cal. We think players from Pittsburgh. We think players from California. Mm-hmm. But we don't necessarily think Pitt and Cal as top 25 recruiting classes. And two coaches that are defensive guys at the heart, but they've done a really good job in their region, local league. I think what's been the most impressive about Cal, you know, Dan, you know, as a Pac-12 guy, one of the biggest problems Sonny Dykes had was recruiting Northern California, and he could not get it done. He inherited Jared Goff from Jeff Tedford, but he couldn't recruit the Bay, couldn't recruit Northern California. Justin Wilcox comes in. He's got eight guys from Sacramento, from the East Bay, and that's what Cal needs to do to stay competitive in the Pac-12. So not used to seeing, you know, Pitt and Cal in the top 25. Those are the two that probably are the biggest surprise. I think the, you know, on the flip side, probably the one that's the most disappointing is the kind of day that Mississippi State ended up having. And I think also looking at what Stanford did, I mean, we're used to seeing Stanford with top 10, top 15 classes. It wasn't but 3 years ago that they landed three of the top five players in the country. Now they had the 61st ranked class in the country. So were the grad transfers last year speaking to a bigger issue that was going on at Stanford? This recruiting class doesn't really reflect those early David Shaw classes.
Let's go back to the state of California for a second. Your website 24/7 has USC on the front page as one of the winners of National Signing Day. That's in pretty stark contrast, Brandon, to last recruiting cycle when they finished like dead last in the Pac-12. Is there a turnaround story here that we should be telling? Was last year just an outlier? What's the deal with USC?
Well, I think there was a couple things at play. First, they replaced the entire defensive staff. So you bring in three coaches. Well, four coaches at that, two that have Southern California ties, Vic Soto, who they hired away from Virginia, is a San Diego native, then Dante Williams, who is an L.A. guy, had been at Arizona, had been at Nebraska, had been at Oregon. He shows up at USC. All of a sudden, their DB recruiting improves. But the big thing was really Todd Orlando and Craig Nybar coming in and just kind of jolting in that defensive staff, where you get away from kind of the, you know, the, I don't know how to describe Clancy Pendergast, but the unexciting recruiting that Clancy Pendergast did over the years. And you have this entire offseason where USC is not playing, and then you get on the field and they're winning some games, but kind of winning in exciting fashion. And they just really seemed to up kind of their energy level, even in a year where they weren't able to get on the road. They weren't able to get kids to come to campus. They did have a little junior day about 4 days before the pandemic happened, and were able to get a few guys to come to campus before the NCAA shut things down. But I also think they benefited a lot from more guys in California probably staying closer to home because of the pandemic. Naturally, USC always becomes an attractive option. So I think there's, you know, last year there were so many questions coming off the 2018 season about Clay Helton. This year there were less questions, and then he kind of reshifted that staff around so you could see the success. But I think that the Pac-12 championship game could go a long way in really determining Oregon or USC recruiting dominance over the next 5 to 6 years.
You mentioned guys staying closer to home in California, probably because of the pandemic. But still, you look at the best players in California. You see LSU, Notre Dame, Ohio State, Clemson, Georgia. Like they're continuing a trend that, you know, last year was highlighted by DJ Uiagalelei and CJ Stroud, guys like that leaving the West Coast footprint. I guess it's very easy to say, well, Pac-12 teams are down and they're not playing exciting football. They're not playing on the national stage, and when they do, they're not performing. I think that's right. But also when you look at those staffs, I guess like how USC was, but you look at UCLA, you look at, you know, even though an improved Cal, you look at Stanford, you look at, you know, Washington State going through what they've gone through. Is it also an element of the recruiting killers that existed at some of these schools are elsewhere, and that they're just not staffed with guys who are as, I guess, dogged? Is that an element to this?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I also think you look at, say, what happened to Colorado, where Mel Tucker leaves right before signing day. So Carl Durrell comes in mid-February. Oh, I'm going to use March to have kids come to campus. And then March 12th, everything shuts down for the next 9 months. Same with Nick Rolovich. He gets hired in mid-January, has to finish putting together the final touches on the 2020 class. I'll use February to, you know, start to build relations with these guys. And then in March, we'll have them come to campus. Same thing happens. So you get some coaches that have more energy on the recruiting trail, have better recruiters, but they weren't ever able to turn loose, or they weren't ever able to host guys on campus. But then you have other schools where, you know, they don't have the coaches that necessarily have that bulldog mentality. There's not a Dante Williams on the recruiting trail. You know, there's not the guys that, you know, you see Mario Cristobal. I mean, Mario Cristobal is turning into the West Coast version of Nick Saban in terms of he is becoming the face of Oregon recruiting. And when you look at a lot of schools in the country, they have an assistant who's kind of the face of the recruiting, and that's why recruiting is so successful. But when you look at Alabama, you have Saban, who's that closer, and that's what Mario Cristobal was able to do, is close up a lot of these guys without ever even getting the chance to see them. And his staff knows they've got to recruit with the same energy and vigor that their head coach does. But when you have other coaches in the Pac-12 that, and I think we know one in particular, Dan, that you've got a long history of following, Chip Kelly. When recruiting isn't the most important thing, that trickles down to the rest of the assistants, and right, then your class ends up where it does because you don't have that top-down philosophy of get out on the road and go recruit. And I think we see that a lot in the Pac-12 right now with schools that have been recruiting well. They have head coaches. I mean, for all the crud that Clay Helton deals with, he still is a really good recruiter, and kids love Clay Helton. Kids, when they go on their visit, they talk about how they really connect with him, how their family connects with him. He does a great job of recruiting. And so you're seeing that maybe last year was an anomaly, but when you have guys on your staff that really recruit energetically and the head coach himself does that, that's where you have this wide gap between some of the top schools in the Pac-12 and really with the rest of the Pac-12.
Brandon, I'm fascinated by your breakdown of what's going on in the Big Ten. So we talked about Ohio State. Ohio State, obviously, cream of the crop. Michigan, all things considered, did pretty well. But within the Big Ten itself, I'm looking at the 24/7 rankings. We've got Wisconsin at third, which is a pretty good cycle for them. We've got Maryland at fourth. Maryland did really well, keeping guys close to home, flipping a kid from Michigan to come to Maryland. We got Penn State at fifth. We got Nebraska all the way down at seventh. Is there any kind of like tectonic shift afoot here where we've got programs outperforming? What does this cycle tell you about where the Big Ten's going over the next couple seasons?
Well, it tells you one thing, that it's going to keep going to Columbus, and that's where the players seem to come and want to play. I mean, let's just talk about Ohio State for a second, because you look at last year, they signed the number one receiver in the country, the number three receiver in the country, the number five receiver in the country, and then another top 10 receiver. This year, they get the number one receiver in the country. They've already got a commitment from the number one receiver in the country for the 2022 class. So you've got this full receiver room, and nobody's running away. It reminds me of the running back room at USC under Pete Carroll. We have all this talent, and guys aren't fearing it. But then you also look at the quarterback room. You've got a Justin Fields. You've got a C.J. Stroud, who's set to maybe take over for him next year. But then could C.J. Stroud become Ohio State's Kelly Bryant? And that Quinn Ewers, maybe the highest rated quarterback over the last 4 years since Trevor Lawrence, he's committed in the 2022 class. Does C.J. Stroud start in 2021? Because I got to assume Justin Fields is gone. But then Quinn Ewers comes in 2022. So Ohio State is just recruiting at a whole different level than the rest of the Big Ten. So now it's a matter of, well, are we recruiting for second? And you still, it's not a surprise to see Michigan there at number two, but Wisconsin, I mean, they do such a good job of evaluating guys early on. And case in point, Santa Barbara High School quarterback Deacon Hill committed to Wisconsin a year and a half ago when he had only started two games as a sophomore, took over when his quarterback got injured and became the starter. Paul Chryst offers him in the summer. He commits despite having three sisters that played water polo at UCLA and his brother-in-law who played football at UCLA. That was his dream school. UCLA doesn't offer him. He commits to Wisconsin. A year later, Chip Kelly tries to flip him. He said, where were you guys a year ago? He sticks with it. And now he's grown into one of the top 10 pro-style quarterbacks in the country. So you look at where Graham Mertz, they bring him in, and they don't bring in a quarterback in the next class. Then they go get a Deacon Hill. I mean, when Paul Chryst hits on a quarterback, it usually works, but it's because they do such a good job of developing, but evaluating those guys early. Maryland, we're not surprised. Mike Loxton can recruit. But I think the surprise is not just Nebraska down there at seventh, but we've been used to kind of seeing Minnesota recruiting picked up a lot over the last couple of years under PJ Fleck. And they're kind of at a, you know, number eight spot where we're not expecting them to be that low. You would have thought with the season they had in 2019, they would see the bump in the 2021 class. And it was kind of to the contrary. It wasn't nearly as strong of a class as maybe we expected it to be. So there's a couple of schools that finally had some momentum, and yet this class kind of stagnated. Then, of course, you go look and you see an Illinois at the bottom. Well, they've had coaching turnover. You see Northwestern. I mean, Pat Fitzgerald's probably excited that he's not in the top 10 for the Big Ten because he uses that to motivate his team every single year. Indiana, again, we talk about this every year. The bump in recruiting usually comes in the class after your season. So right. I don't think Indiana's class right now at number 12 is anything to worry about. I think you'll see Tom Allen's class really improved in 2022, where they've had this whole season to really kind of burn Indiana into the mind of a lot of these recruits.
And I guess on a similar note, if we could shift over to the ACC for a second, the ACC in a similar position, right? We've got one team at the top, Clemson, far and away better than the competition. We do have some other teams that are trying to close that gap.
And we're not counting Notre Dame in this question, right?
We're not counting Notre Dame
okay,
in this question.
Okay, just making sure.
Not a full...
Longtime ACC standout.
Not a full paying member of the ACC. But we've got some other schools now in the form of Miami, North Carolina, perhaps trying to chase down the Clemson Tigers. That's part one of the question. How are they doing? Part two of the question is how about a school like a Florida State? Because Mike Norvell's had a ton of challenges to deal with in his very young tenure in Tallahassee. And we know that they're getting Mackenzie Milton via the transfer portal, but he is trying to rebuild something there. And we have a lot of Florida State fans who listen to this show. So A, is the gap closing on Clemson at all? And B, how's Florida State looking?
Well, Florida State class, again, when we talk about schools that you're not used to seeing maybe in a particular spot, seeing Florida State at number six wouldn't be a surprise if that was nationally. That's not where you expect to see them in the ACC. Like last year, when we saw USC at 10th. In the Pac-12, 10th in the country would still be low by USC standards, but Florida State is clearly, you know, kind of getting, I wouldn't say lapped, but you have more stability at Miami with Manny Diaz. You have more stability at Florida with Dan Mullen. So now you've got your third coach in 4 years of Florida State. I think Mike Norvell is going to be able to get things going there at some point. But right now, maybe the class doesn't appear as sexy as some of these other classes where, you know, Florida and Miami are both showing signs of life. Obviously, Miami is having a great year and not having to hit the transfer portal as hard. I mean, so many of their star players on their team are transfers, the Jalen Phillips and De'Aaron King. But I know Manny Diaz would really rather build his program with high schoolers. And so you look at this class, and it is a top 10 class. It's the number two class of the ACC. That's where you expect Miami to be. North Carolina at number three. What's the most remarkable thing about North Carolina class is there's actually two things. It's one, how many of their players, their top players, are kids from North Carolina, a state that used to kind of bleed to the rest of the SEC and the ACC. Now Mac Brown's keeping those guys just like he used to do with Texas. But I think the other most remarkable thing is that they finished with a class that was number three in the ACC. And then if you look at it nationally, it was number 14 after they lost their number one recruit who reclassified to the 2020 class and Tony Grimes and played this year for North Carolina. I mean, that's when you know you're living right and you're recruiting well, when you can afford to lose a recruit because he wanted to get to campus a year earlier to go play. And then you look at this class and it's North Carolina, North Carolina, North Carolina, a bunch of in-state kids. They've got a five-star defensive lineman in Keyshawn Silver. They got Drake May, who's the younger brother of former Carolina Hooper Luke May. So they've got guys that have ties to the Tar Heels, and Mac Brown knows how to recruit better than most coaches in college football, and certainly knows how to recruit his backyard better than most coaches do. And North Carolina is seeing that. So, you know, North Carolina is showing with Mac Brown the complete just rejuvenation of that program, but also the rejuvenation of North Carolina favor with the in-state recruits.
When you look at the Big 12, normally it's a question of like who comes after Oklahoma and Texas, because Oklahoma and Texas have cleaned up. I'd say kind of a down year from Texas, I'm sure, surrounding some of the uncertainty around Tom Herman's future. Oklahoma seems to keep, you know, having a national presence, obviously bringing in top receivers, bringing in, you know, the top quarterback in the country from, you know, thousands of miles away. Are you worried about Texas long term, even given the advantages that they have? And also, who is that team chasing those two teams just in terms of talent acquisition?
I'm worried about Texas because not only are they losing in-state kids that you would have thought they got, they're losing them to Ohio State. So now Texas, we thought when Texas A&M went to the SEC that the SEC schools were going to thrive in the state of Texas. Ohio State's the one that's thriving in the state of Texas. And it all kind of started with Garrett Wilson a couple of years ago. I mean, you can even go back to recruits before that, but Garrett Wilson was the one that really shifted the paradigm, I think, in the state of Texas towards Ohio State and with the Horns, because Quinn Ewers was a Texas commit, and then he flipped to Ohio State. Then Caleb Burton, who was an in-state kid, is going to Ohio State. So Texas is having a hard enough time catching Oklahoma, but now Ohio State's stealing guys that you would have thought would have been a lock for the Horns at one point. So I think they're, you know, it's not just the questions about Tom Herman. It's why is Texas losing so many of these players, the state to out-of-state, out-of-conference schools? And that's an issue that California is very familiar with, and sure, Texas is now starting to experience. And at the same time, I think that hurts the rest of the Big 12 when the Big 10, the SEC, the ACC are even planting in the state of Texas and grabbing guys. But the one that I think is probably the biggest surprise here in terms of where they're rated is West Virginia. They're at number four. They actually had a really good class here with 3 4-star players. But I really like what Neil Brand did with this class. And then I see earlier this week that his name's being linked to the Auburn job. I mean, it's one of those where you finally start getting some momentum. He's starting to get his own blood in there. Yeah. And yet now schools want him. So can West Virginia sustain it where they can be a top four, top five class in the Big 12, given their geographical disadvantage? If they can, they're going to be competing for Big 12 championships, or at least for a shot there. I like what Baylor has done. I mean, considering when Dave Aranda got started there and how late it was in the process, and really losing, again, like Carl Durrell and Nick Rolovich, losing the opportunity to get those kids to come to campus and meet with them as a new coach, I still kind of like what Baylor did in this class. And I think given a full year and more kind of a return to normalcy, Baylor's going to have a really good recruiting class. What probably the biggest surprise, though, is we've seen TCU have some great classes. We've seen TCU signing some really great players, but this year was not that year. And I think there's some concern about the TCU program. Only 2 4-stars total and only 13 commits. They have the smallest class in the Big 12. we know that Gary Patterson can coach those guys up, but you know what's happening this year? Again, it's another case of those kids that TCU in years past may have gotten, now they're going to other Big Ten schools, or they're going to other ACC or SEC schools. That state has opened the floodgates to other programs outside of Texas.
I hate to group G5 teams together because it's a wide swath of teams at very different schools all across the country, but I'm doing it anyway because it's my show and I'm allowed to. Largely the American of the G5 conferences is the conference that dominated recruiting by teams you'd expect to dominate just on a national scale, Cincinnati, SMU, Memphis. It's just UCF looks like they have at least a pretty good class. Which of those, or any school across the country not playing in a Power 5 conference, or I guess Notre Dame, has jumped out to you as doing impressive things on the recruiting trail, all things considered?
Well, I like what Cincinnati did. They may not have any 4-stars in this class, but they all have really high-level 3-stars. And that's really where your recruiting class is made. I mean, yes, you want the 5-stars. You want the 4-stars. Although some coaches may say they don't. You still want those top-tier guys, but so much of your class is made on that second tier of guys. And that's where Cincinnati's class ends up being the best in the AAC, despite not having a 4-star. It's like all 25 guys are just solid players that really kind of, that Luke Fickell and his staff just see as guys that can keep that momentum that Cincinnati has built over the last couple of years. And I think what's been most impressive is, I mean, this is a guy whose name has been mentioned for a number of jobs over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And we saw this with Boise State when Chris Peterson was there. Every year, Chris Peterson's name was mentioned for some big job. Every year, Boise State still brought in a good class because you could see the commitment that Cincinnati has to replacing Tommy Tuberville notwithstanding. Cincinnati over the last 15 years has done a good job with their head coaching hires. And so even if Fickell does leave, he's continued to build on that great program. And so it makes it easy to sell that program. SMU, I think we talked about a little bit earlier on the show about Sonny Dykes' lack of success in the state of California when he was at Cal, because he's a Texas guy. His wheelhouse is the state of Texas. His wheelhouse is inside the Texas high school football, whether, you know, being a Dykes there in the state of Texas, all the connections. And now you see at SMU, remember there was a little bit of a time there when June Jones was the head coach at SMU where they were recruiting nationally. And
yeah,
he was from Hawaii, or he was from the West Coast, was coaching in Hawaii, but they were hitting the West Coast hard. They were hitting the East Coast hard. Now you're seeing SMU really build on this class locally, but it's becoming appealing. At the same time, as TCU may be trending down from a recruiting standpoint, SMU seems to be trending up. So Sonny Dykes has found his sweet spot. That's where he needs to be. That's what, when he's recruiting a Texas kid, it's a lot easier to get him to go to SMU than it is to Berkeley. So those are the two. And then, of course, you go to the Mountain West. I mean, they have 7 schools, the top 6 schools of the Mountain West. 5 had new coaches, so they had a lot of excitement, a lot of things to sell. Heck, UNLV's got the #2 class in the Mountain West because they were selling Marcus Arroyo and his Rose Bowl, and they were selling the new stadium with the Raiders, and then they went a horrific, 0-whatever this year.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have the #2 class, yet what hasn't changed? Boise State still has the #1 class. This doesn't have a lot of commitment. It's got the 2nd smallest class in the Mountain West, or 3rd smallest class in the Mountain West, and yet there they are again, with the best class, highest average rating of recruit, highest point total of the conference. I mean, Brian Harsin, his name is now being mentioned again, like Chris Peterson, not with the same fervor that Peterson was, but Harsin's name, Mike Fickell, is mentioned with a lot of jobs. And yet Boise State coaches keep trucking along and bringing in good classes.
You haven't physically seen as many players and how they look today, how they physically look in a camp or during games, or you haven't seen as many as you normally do by this time of year, especially with the All-American games and the practices beforehand. But if you had to group a few guys across the country that purely reflect how you reacted to seeing like A'shaun Robinson or Trevor Lawrence, guys that you can't believe are still in high school that are so clearly physically ready and technique ready for college football, who are those guys that are like, oh, this gentleman looks like a 25-year-old? Who are those physically beyond ready guys in this class?
I remember seeing James Williams, who is the #1 safety in the country. He's committed to Miami. He's been committed to Miami for, I think, 3 years. I saw him at the end of his sophomore year at a 7-on-7 tournament in Las Vegas, and he was playing with his team DEFCON. And at the time, I didn't know where DEFCON was from, so So, but you could hear this kid. He was loud. He was energetic. He was fun. I'm like, this has got to be a team from Florida. Sure enough, it was. And here he is. He was 6'5", 215 pounds as a sophomore. He'd be playing corner one play. He played linebacker the next play. He played safety the next play. And we had him as a top 50 guy already in this class, but you could have convinced me in whatever that was, February of 2019, that he could go play at Miami right away, but he wasn't going to get there for two more years. So he was the one guy that I'm like, 2 years ago, he could go. The other one that I probably thought, you know, obviously I've been a big fan of JT Tuimoloau since he first started, but I remember seeing Corey Foreman as a sophomore. And then he goes to the opening finals as an underclassman. I think he was the only underclass defensive lineman that was at the last opening finals in Texas in 2019. And he won the MVP, dominated. I mean, Brian Brzee was there that day, and Corey Foreman was the one who left with the MVP. And he still had two more years of high school football that he had. And then I remember seeing Emeka Egbuka for the first time when he was a ninth grader. And then I got to see him again in that winter when he was in a 7-on-7 tournament. And you could just see that this kid had the makings of a special receiver. Even as a sophomore, he goes and runs a 4.42 laser 40 at the Army Combine in January of his sophomore year. Over the course of the next 48 hours, he and his father or his stepdad were on my flight home. I think he landed about 15 offers from Friday afternoon until Sunday night. We landed back in Seattle, and you could have told me then he could go play 2 years and or he could go to college right now, but he has two more years of high school football. There was a reason that he was the National Junior of the Year last year, just a grown man playing a grown man's sport, but against high school kids. And that's why I think he's going to have an opportunity to play. Even though it's a loaded receiver room at Ohio State, I think he'll play as a true freshman next year because he is more than college ready.
Something I've always been curious about, and it changes every year, but a lot of the dirty work in recruiting, and I don't say that to imply anything, more the tiring day-to-day minutia of college football recruiting is done by support staff at these various programs with the biggest schools investing in the biggest staffs in that department. What does that dirty work involve? What is that daily grind that people way, way down on that athletic staff directory on the webpage, what are they doing? And how much is what they're doing versus how much of what coaches are doing is sealing these deals?
I would say that coaches do a good job in recruiting when they do the recruiting, because the majority of the recruiting is being done by the 23-year-old staffer who's got access to the head coach's phone, who's got access to the offensive coordinator's Twitter, who's got access to the defensive coordinator's Instagram and sends those messages as that coach, but it's not that coach who's sending it. And he's the one that's building the relationship. And then when they go on an in-home visit, they'll do them in this cycle. But when a coach is getting ready to go on an in-home visit, that 23-year-old staffer is on the phone basically saying, okay, coach, these are the main bullet points that you don't know because you've never recruited this kid. Go close the deal on him by telling this, that, wow, and that, complimenting mom, complimenting grandma. Those guys work their tails off. I was texting with a few yesterday. They're in the office at 3 a.m. yesterday, and assistant coaches, you know, they get their two or three, and that's not all assistant coaches, but there are some that they're clearly there for their X's and O's ability and not for their recruiting chops. They get their two commits in June, and they're done, and yet it's the 25-year-old staffer who's maintaining that relationship for 7 months after the kid commits in May to ensure that the kid still signs with that school and that he's not being ghosted by the coach who recruited him. So those guys work their tails off and don't get any of the credit. They don't get any of the glory. When there's a National Recruiter of the Year named or a Conference Recruiter of the Year, it's usually an assistant coach. Usually that assistant coach does do his own recruiting, but so much of the groundwork is laid by the staffers and by the admin staff. And that's why we saw last year USC really kind of talk about, well, the part of the reason our class is down is because we don't have the admin or the support staff like the SEC schools do. So what does USC do? They hire three or four new administrators in the football recruiting office to ramp up their efforts. They hire new media guys from LSU to get all hands on deck because so much of the work is done by those guys rather than the assistant coaches who they're trying to coach during the season.
Brandon, I got two questions before we let you go. Again, he is the national recruiting editor for 24/7 Sports. One topic that we haven't covered here, I'm sure we will cover more in the future, is this whole name, image, and likeness legislation that seemingly is closer now than ever before to becoming any kind of reality. Is that something that recruits or even recruiters are broaching at all, either amongst themselves or with people such as yourself?
No question. And I think Oklahoma kind of showed a sneak preview of that a year ago when, if you remember at signing day last year, they had each recruit that signed had his own logo, his own branding done, and had his own logo designed as part of his announcement. When Lincoln Riley got the letter of intent in, they would tweet this kid's own personal logo. And so there's schools that realize this is going to be a hot button issue. You're going to have some of your old schools that are going to still try to fight it. But then you have the schools that realize we can benefit from this if we just get out in front and say, hey, we're going to help you with your branding. We're going to help you with your name, with your marketing. And this is what we can do for you. We saw USC about a month and a half ago, two months ago, do a campaign. Ultimately, it got taken down by their own Twitter. But at one point, it was up there with the boulevard that they were pushing. And, you know, Hollywood. And one of the key recruits in this class who didn't sign yesterday was Sierre Wright, who is one of the top 100 players in the country. He's a corner at Loyola High School in Los Angeles. He's going to star in Space Jam 2 next year as LeBron James' son. Well, USC has been pushing hard for him, and it's hard to think that a kid who's going to star in what's probably going to be a billion-dollar movie, if we were allowed to go to the movies in 2021, he's going to leave Hollywood, where his name, image, and likeness as a football player is only going to enhance his brand. But you're going to see more and more schools incorporate, and we've seen that over the last two signing days, where more and more schools have incorporated the branding. When Ohio State would announce a recruit yesterday, they would announce where the kid was from, his position, his height and weight, and then they would also put his Twitter and his Instagram to build up his brand, to build up his social media presence. And more schools are going to do that. And I think the sooner they adapt to that and understand that this is going to be what helps them in recruiting, gone are the days where the photo shoot's the most important thing. It's now, how can you improve my brand?
Final question, perhaps the most important question. There was a player in this class who goes by the name of Sam Jackson, Brandon. We've been doing the name game here on the show for a long time. Never have we had a Sam Jackson before. I'm wondering if there are any other names that rise to that level in this year's class.
I was prepared for this one this year because usually every year I get thrown off and I always have a name and then I forget them. Clemson. I mean, Dabo's got a quarterback coming in named Bubba. If there is not a more perfect just marriage between a head coach and a quarterback, Dabo and Bubba pretty much checks every box. I like what USC is getting out of a kid. I wrote about him this week because he got invited to the All-American Bowl. Prophet Brown. As a corner, you know, his ability to anticipate and get a good break on that pass from the quarter
or see the future
is going to allow it. He's going to see the future. He's going to know how to jump routes. So that's probably, I love Prophet, but I mean, come on, Bubba and Dabo. Are we really going to try to find something better than that? I have two more because I've been on the, pounding the train for the last couple of weeks that, in my opinion, that the best receiver in college football is DeVonta Smith. Well, guess what? Alabama's got another DeVonta Smith coming in. He's playing cornerback this time. So, you know, we say Alabama every year, they reload. I mean, they literally reload where they get the same name players coming in every single year. And then I got to throw a nod to you, Dan, because we can't have a class with a guy named Kingsley and not talk about a offensive lineman named Kingsley. The last name is not always the easiest to pronounce. When you have a name like Kingsley, we don't talk about your last name.
Does Oregon not have future bookends of Kingsley and Bram? Is that true?
Bram Walden.
Bram and sure Kingsley.
Okay. And a center named Jackson Light, who is not light at all.
Oh, I like that. Here's the actual tradition that we have other than the great names is let's just be very vain and self-serving. Go deep on Notre Dame's class and go deep on Oregon's class. Not a question, a command.
Notre Dame class. Hey, I like what Notre Dame did. They got a couple kids. First of all, anytime you go into the 805 where we all know the best football in the world actually is played, Dan, you do know that. So, you'll be excited when I hear that, Devin Apu is one of the top players in Ventura County in this class. He was a longtime commit to UCLA and they flipped him a week ago. What I like here is that we're seeing with Notre Dame's classes, we're continuing to see the Manti Te'o effect. We saw it last year when they got Jordan Batello. this year they were able to get Kahanu Kia from Punahou. And this is the kid who was originally talking about taking his mission and going and serving his LDS mission right away. And Nebraska, Utah, his dad played at Utah. Utah thought that they were going to get him and he was going to go serve his mission, come back in 2022. And then Brian Polian did what he does. He goes into Hawaii and he gets a linebacker. So you look at Notre Dame's class, and obviously they've got Tyler Buckner. He's the star. Blake Fisher, a kid from Indiana, one of the top linemen in the country. Rocco Spindler, another great name out of Michigan, who they battled Michigan for. But they've done a really good job out west this year. And, you know, maybe that's because of an Ian Book. Maybe it's because of an Isaiah Foskey, some of the guys on their team that are from the West Coast. And Notre Dame's always had a presence, but this year it seemed to be, interestingly enough, in a year where they couldn't really get on the road, they had a few more guys from the West Coast than maybe we've seen in the last couple of years. The other name of a guy that I'm a big fan of in this class is quarterback by the name of Ron Paulus. I just think that, you know, there's going to be a guarantee of a couple Heisman Trophy winners for the young man when he gets to Notre Dame.
Had to go Ron Paulus to close this out, didn't you?
I was just sitting there waiting for him, and I just was like, oh, do I drop it early or do I wait till the end?
We're all friends here. Why not? All right.
What about Oregon, the Oregon class? Give me some Oregon juice.
Yeah. I love this Oregon class. I think what I really like about Oregon is when they recruit in-state, it's usually for an elite guy. They don't always recruit in-state, but one of their earliest commits in this class was a commit from Keith Brown, who committed after the Civil War in 2019, only to see Noah Sewell and Justin Flo commit at that same position and sign a year ahead of them. And yet it didn't matter. Keith Brown became their most vocal recruiter. And in a day and age, in an era where social media recruiting is becoming such a part of the recruiting process, Keith Brown was one of the few guys in the state of Oregon who actually had the opportunity to play for the Ducks and just continued to recruit. He had guys come and stay with him, and then they would go down and be able to walk around campus. They wouldn't get to meet with the coaches, but he kind of hosted a few of these guys that would come into town to see Oregon. And I think that that's a big deal for Oregon, because as much as they recruit nationally, when you do have an elite player in your backyard, you go get them. Speaking of backyards, they have made it a permanent residence in Arizona, getting the number one quarterback in Arizona, Ty Thompson. They got the top lineman in Arizona and Bram Walden. They got, I think, three players from Arizona that were right in the backyard of either U of A or ASU, Jonah Miller, another four-star lineman. And they also got two really good tight ends, Maliki Matabao. They got Terrence Ferguson out of Colorado. What I think is probably the most remarkable thing that Oregon continues to do is to go into the Pac-12 footprint and to go into four or five other states where there's Pac-12 schools and take their top prospect. That's what USC used to do under Pete Carroll. That's what USC is expected to do. And right now, Mara Cristobal is the one that's going in to the backyard of other Pac-12 programs and taking their top guys.
All right. One final time, his name is Brandon Huffman, National Recruiting Editor for 24/7 Sports, calling in from the great state of Alaska. First time that's ever happened on this podcast in all the years we've been doing it. Brandon, thank you as always for your insight. Please stay warm up there, and hopefully we can talk to you again sometime soon.
Absolutely. I'm going to stay as thawed out as possible.
All right. Take care. All righty. There you go. Brandon Huffman, calling in from the great state of Alaska.
You been up there?
Nope. Have you?
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. Went on a cruise in high school. It's the only cruise, I think, like extended cruise I've ever been on.
You a cruise guy? You like cruises?
No, not at all.
No?
But I had a good time. Like, I'm not a cruise guy because I had a bad time on that cruise. You go up there, I think it was, we went up to Seattle and then maybe went up to Vancouver and took it from there, like an Alaskan cruise, and you see glaciers. It's pretty dramatic and crazy beautiful. We went, you know, into towns and went bike riding and, you know, I don't know what, it's not, I'm saying Alaska isn't a summer destination, but that's not true. It was beautiful and there's a lot of outdoors things to do. But just the idea of sitting on a giant boat and eating until you're sick, and I was too young to gamble. Maybe I wasn't. I don't know what the rules are on the open seas, but I don't know. It just wasn't my scene. I like to explore a little more than a cruise allows.
What was Richard Rubenstein like on that trip?
Gosh, this was a long time ago. This was probably 20-ish years ago. I think he enjoyed as much as he could the sights and sounds of being, I think we went to Ketchikan and maybe Juneau. I forget the specific towns we went to in Alaska, but I think he had as good a time as one can with a, let's call it 15, 13, and 10-year-old boy just being idiots. So it's not like you can truly take in the wonders and the vistas of the upper Pacific Northwest.
Right.
But I think he had a good time. He's obviously, as you know, traveled a ton and hiked a ton. So he was in his element.
Well, look, fun show as always. Always great to have Brandon
show
on this show. You know how I am about fun, Dan. I love fun.
You love fun shows.
And Brandon always delivers. Dude knows everything. Everything about recruiting. Always good to get his
He also makes me feel at home because he's got a Southern California affect that the Pacific Northwest just can't beat out of him. It just can't. He's from Ventura County. Always likes making reference to it. So, you know, Oxnard and Ventura and Channel Islands, that whole area. It's fantastic. You should spend time there, Ty. So don't tell too many people, but it's great. You can eat well. Oceans, everything. Oceans. I treasure these shows. So uncommitted Friday Orbit, because we are still uncommitted. And I am hopeful that Oregon's class comes together and maybe some other Pac-12 classes come together. And we get a higher level Pac-12 and some underrated Big 12 classes come together for, you know, guys taking off or guys, what's the word I'm looking for? Just taking the wind out of Oklahoma sails a little bit, Clemson sails a little bit. I know you're keenly interested in the ACC and if Notre Dame sticks around and classes like theirs, Miami's, North Carolina's. I think it was a fun class. The Ohio States and Alabama's and LSU's, and I just expect this from those classes. I'm curious around the edges where teams are slowly building up into dangerous forces.
Dangerous forces. All right. Well, with that being said, thank you so very much for downloading, for listening, for making us part of your week. We got a big weekend in front of us with an incredible slate of conference championship games. We will talk through all of that and much, much more on our Sunday reaction show. Again, you can get access to it on Sunday if you join the Patreon. Otherwise, for all the just plain old-fashioned regular footballers, you get it on Monday morning, 6 a.m. Eastern time. That's when we start talking about what happened. Play your reverbs, which, again, you can dial into at 408-VERBAL-1. 408-VERBAL-1 is your line of catharsis, Dan. Call in. Let us know what's on your mind. If anything's bugging you, got anything to get off your chest, that's where you can do it. 408-VERBAL-1.
I agree.
For that guy over there, my good friend, Dan Rubenstein. For myself, Ty Hildebrandt. We'll catch y'all in a few days. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.